Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast. We are coming off what seemed like a pretty sleepy, kind of low number of races, primary night going into a midterm election. There were just contests in a few states, Florida, New York, few others. But it actually ended up having some pretty interesting results. Not necessarily results that will have a immediate impact necessarily on, you know, who's in office, but for the thing that a lot of people are very focused on right now, which is trying to get some understanding of what is happening going into the midterm elections. If you're a political obsessive, that's always going to be something you're focused on. But in this cycle, it is particularly the case because everything is kind of upended. Usually we have a standard set of metrics that we follow to say, okay, you know, this party's going to have a good election, that party's going to have a good election, but they're really kind of all pointing in weird directions. On the one hand, you have unemployment, which is, you know, really the most fundamental measure of the economy for how people experience the economy, is at the lowest levels that it has been at in the modern era. More than 50 years. And again, you get much further back than that. You don't even have the same level of record keeping. So, you know, for a very long time. At the same time, for most of this year, people have been saying the economy is terrible. And we know at least some of the reasons why, because there is inflation that most people alive today have not seen inflation at this level during their adult lifetime. You have to go back to the early 1980s to see something at this level. So we know all that. And then you have certain things like, you know, just the basic thing that president's party, first midterm, president's party doesn't do well as a basic rule. You have the fact that Joe Biden has been very unpopular by historical standards, even for the kind of slump that new presidents all, you know, kind of go into, all that kind of stuff. And we've spent most of 2022 expecting a wave election. President's unpopular. Everything's still kind of broken because of COVID. You've got high inflation. You've got all these different kind of things. And yet, that doesn't seem to be how it's working out. There is a general consensus now. You don't have to be looking through rose-colored glasses or through the prism of hope to say that, again, pretty much a consensus, there is no red wave. It's, you know, maybe a red ripple or a red slosh, right? I think most people agree, odds on, Democrats are probably going to hold the Senate, which was not seen as at all likely until relatively recently. And we've seen some of that movement of expectations for the House. I think where most people are, you know, most people who are kind of experts on this stuff would say that Republican prospects for a blowout or even kind of like a big win have diminished a lot. But most people are still saying they are very much, you know, likely to gain control of the House, probably by a narrower margin than anticipated. 10, 15 seats, something like that, but probably still going to win. But things have changed a lot. So this all brings us to what happened last night. So there is a district in New York, which is going to be remapped for, you know, for the November election, for the, you know, for the new Congress. But here in New York, Congressman Delgado, who was, you know, one of these guys, I think he won first in 2018. I don't think 2016, I may have that wrong, but I think 2018, what was a kind of maybe slightly Republican leaning district that a Democrat took over, larger trend in New York State. In any case, he just was appointed to be Lieutenant Governor of New York. So that seat came open. So you have one of these cases where on the same election day yesterday, you had primaries for the November election, and then you had a special election for the last 3 or 4 months of Delgado's term. Okay, all those different things going on. So you had a guy named Pat Ryan, who's like one of the county chiefs in one of the counties in that district, one of the counties kind of a little beyond being a suburb county of New York City, but still in the same general area. And then another guy named Mark Molinaro, the Republican, also county executive of one of the counties. I should know this. I apologize. My colleague Kate will probably know. In any case, here's the thing. Charlie Cook report, calls this a dead even district. Exactly even between Republicans and Democrats. Everybody agrees that Mark Molinaro was like the perfect Republican candidate for this district. County executive, you know, not some Republican crazy, but, you know, enough to appeal to those people. There's a lot of rural areas in this district. So if this is a Republican wave year, Molinaro is going to win that thing 55-45, a pretty decisive win. And in almost any scenario that people have been foreseeing, he should win that race. He didn't win that race. Pat Ryan won the race, and it seems like the final result will be like 52-48. Close, but a real win, okay? So that has gotten everybody's attention because that result is not consistent with a GOP wave election. It's not really a wave of any magnitude. That looks more like 2020. Looks like that kind of political environment. One that was good for the Democrats, not as good for congressional Democrats as it was for Joe Biden, but the kind of political environment that's kind of like a jump ball in political terms, right? Maybe advantage to the Democrats. Now, added to this is that we have now had 5 special elections for the House. You know, there's a vacancy. You have a kind of a little impromptu election to fill out a term. Okay. We've had 5 of those since the Dobbs decision, since Roe v. Wade was overturned. In all 5 of those cases, the Democratic candidate, whether they won or lost, outperformed Joe Biden by at least 2 percentage points. Now, these are all low turnout elections by definition. They're primaries, like in the middle of the year, middle of the summer, whatever. So you can't say, okay, this is the percentage and it's going to, every race in you know, November is going to be like that. You can't say that. But again, those kind of results are not at all consistent with any kind of GOP wave scenario or even one where the Republicans have a big advantage. So that has really gotten everybody's attention. Now, there's one big factor here, and that is that, you know, for most of the 2020-2022 redistricting, Democrats, kind of to everybody's surprise, were kind of holding their own, at least holding their own, maybe even kind of making some progress on the redistricting front. But then very late in the game, Republicans, in some cases basically by defying state courts, got big wins in New York State, Ohio, and Florida. Those are key redistrictings that mean that Republicans seem to have a certain amount of gains just locked in. Now, I would say that if it were not for, if we were running the 2012 through 2020 map again in 2022, with what we have seen in these special elections and just all the other factors we're looking at, I think you'd have to say the House is like a jump ball or close to it in that ballpark, right? Either party could take it. But it's not the same map. You do have a map that is substantially more difficult for the Democrats. But, you know, what we saw last night is basically, I think this is a fair way to put it. What we saw last night is that it's possible Democrats could actually have a better environment for Congress than they did in 2020. And so the assumption that we've all been operating on, you know, at best, they'll kind of, you know, get the same level of support, but it'll be against a worse map. Maybe not. Let's be frank. I still would say the odds are definitely against the Democrats for holding the House. But it looks a lot more possible now. And this isn't just me, you know, looking at the facts through the prism of faith. Everybody's seeing this. Everybody's seeing that the political environment looks substantially different than what almost everybody thought it was in the spring. And there are a number of factors there. One is that there has been, inflation appears to have crested. There has been a substantial drop in gas prices, which is the thing that most people see, right? Whatever the big kind of global metrics are, people see that, like, wow, gas is like $5 a gallon. That's happened for in terms of Democratic enthusiasm. You have the IRA, the kind of mini BBB Act. Just today, President Biden just, you know, finally did this sort of student debt relief issue. But the big thing, I think, is Dobbs. That has changed things dramatically, because obviously that is an existential issue for a lot of people in this country. And beyond the issue of, I think even beyond the issue of reproductive rights, it has catalyzed this sense of, like, how did we get to a Supreme Court that is suddenly in charge of everything, right? That we're kind of just bystanders for what this kind of stacked court decides. So that is what we're going to discuss today. We're going to get into a lot of, you know, we're going to talk about New York 19, which, among other things, my co-host Kate Riga knows a lot more details about than I do. We're going to get into that, a bunch of other races, and that's what we're going to talk about. Maybe a couple other interesting questions towards the end of the episode. But before we get to that, let me remind you that the Josh Marshall Podcast is brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. Surprise, surprise. It's peak iced coffee season, that wonderful time of year when you start planning your next iced coffee order while you're walking home with your current iced coffee. And it's all fun and vibes until you get your July credit card statement. Luckily, there's no need to go cold turkey when saving money is as easy as switching to cold brew. With Grady's Cold Brew Bean Bag Kit, you can brew 36 servings of refreshing New Orleans-style iced coffee for just $1 a cup. That's a major savings compared to buying at your local shop. Plus, you'll have a fridge stocked with coffee when you next get a big craving. Ready to give it a swirl? Get 25% off at gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. That's gradyscoldbrew.com with promo code TPM. Okay, Kate Riga, what is up?
So I think we should kind of start with doing a little backstory on the debacle that was New York redistricting this year, because we're going to talk about a few of these primary races, and none of it would have happened or would, you know, none of it will make sense without this kind of foundation. So basically what happened is New York is one of the very few states where Democrats have the ability to draw lines in a way that kind of ekes them out some extra safe seats. And the reason for that is in a lot of other states that are kind of traditionally Democratic dominated, they have handed that power over to independent commissions, you know, and that is part of this kind of, you know, the idea that gerrymandering is bad and undemocratic and a good government push. So in some places, you know, people have kind of accuse Democrats of unilaterally disarming, kind of choosing to use these panels that will do a more, you know, a more fair division of districts. Whereas Republicans, as we know, do not take that approach. And everywhere that they have power, have eked out the most potential seeds they can have. You know, it was such a, it was the story in Texas this year that they didn't really give themselves more seats because they'd already given themselves so many seats last cycle. There just weren't any more to give. So in New York this year, it took on a lot of importance that Democrats would have to scoop up like, you know, 4 or 5 seats to kind of have some, a bit of a firewall against the Republican gerrymandering. So New York Democrats do this, you know, fairly aggressive gerrymander. Some people said that they went so far as to give courts no choice but to toss the map, which I'm not as sold on. But so they do this aggressive gerrymander. Republicans kind of shop around for the judge that they want, which has become an increasingly common practice, especially in these kind of right-wing lawsuits. And it's worrying for a whole lot of reasons. But they basically found this one guy in this super rural county, which is actually closer to Ohio than it is to New York City. But they gave him the case and he kind of acquiesced. He's like, yep, this is a super unfair gerrymander. You're right, blah, blah, blah. And Democrats still weren't even that worried because they were like, well, they're not going to be able to kind of shop super sympathetic judges all the way up, right? So then now we'll take you to an appeals court. The appellate court also said that the map was an unfair gerrymander and then went up to the next court, the highest court in the state, who a split decision, but also said it was an unfair gerrymander. And rather than give the legislature the ability to kind of fix some of the more egregious lines like some other state courts have, they just went right to a special master and had some guy at a college, you know, kind of just draw the districts himself. And that has engendered a lot of criticism, not just from the people who want, you know, kind of the optimal map for Democrats, but also because the way he did it kind of split a lot of ethnic enclaves and didn't really take into consideration the more intangible stuff, like the kind of spirit of the city, you know, like what groups have just historically been clumped together.
We just made everything a square.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, basically that's it.
Yeah. So that's the map that we got, which to Democrats' chagrin made New York State one of the very few to become more competitive after this round of redistricting rather than less. But it just unfurled chaos on this map. You know, it thrust incumbents into the same districts. It just, for the Democratic Party, it was just catastrophic, you know? So a lot of these races last night, the campaigns were vicious. The decisions were cutthroat. It was bloodthirsty. And that all is a direct ramification of this redistricting. So I guess we can start with kind of one of the banner races that was last night, which was Jerry Nadler versus Carolyn Maloney. Nadler is chair
of...
Let me
ask you a question. Mm-hmm. They both came in 1992, right?
Yep, that's right.
Okay. Are there any New York Republic or New York representatives who've been there longer? Are they like,
that's a good question.
I can't think of any offhand. I mean, it's, you know, you don't have like the Charlie Rangels. I mean, it's weird to think, I mean, on the other hand, that's 30 years ago, but they certainly, I don't mean to interrupt, but those may be two of the most senior members of the delegation.
Yeah.
I really can't. Well, there's no one upstate who's been there longer until relatively recently. Like in the city, you had, I can't remember when, I think Elliot Engel wasn't that far back, but I don't think so.
He's gone too.
Yeah. So. And so these are like the most senior members, two of the most senior members of the delegation, maybe the two most senior, and they had to fight it out.
Yeah. And they had positions kind of befitting that seniority, which is, you know, Nadler was chair of House Judiciary and Maloney is chair of House Oversight, two of the most powerful House committees. And they'd been friends, you know, they came in the same class. They'd been there for ages. They've represented kind of neighboring districts for much of that whole time. And they apparently had like one kind of tepid conversation on the House floor where they were like, okay, well, you shouldn't run in the new district. You should just run over here. And then there was like, no, you should run over there. And then that was about it. And then the knives freaking came out. Vicious, vicious. I mean, Maloney in particular was just going around saying that Nadler is, you know, senile. He's, quote, half dead, that he's just like not able to do the job. And I think that was kind of enforced by when they had a debate, these two, and this younger attorney old Obama campaign staffer Patel, they had a debate and Nadler like sat while the other two stood. And he is definitely, you know, he's had health problems, he has arthritis, whatnot. But I mean, vicious stuff.
I mean, they both must be in their mid-70s.
Yeah, actually Maloney's a year older than Nadler, but he is, I mean, he's definitely, I think, showing visible signs of age. I don't think anyone would contest that. But, you know, it's not the kind of attack you lodge when you're trying to preserve a personal relationship.
You don't come back from that. Especially when you say, it's one thing to say someone's in poor health, but when you talk about mental acuity, that's really, you just don't come back from that.
Right.
But
yeah.
I guess Nadler doesn't need to come back from that.
And then Nadler's camp kind of did more of the thing is, like, these two people have very, very similar voting records, right? So he had to go back to, like, her vote on the Iraq war to find something to criticize her about. And then there was also, you know, an unsavory undercurrent from his camp where I guess she's just kind of weird and says weird things. And then, you know,
the
most
vaccine
acute
stuff.
Has the vaccine stuff. But even other than that is just kind of, like, kooky, but they were insinuating that that kookiness has some overlap with a potential drinking problem. So we're talking about
I had actually missed a lot of this stuff. I knew it got nasty. I didn't know all of the details. And then simultaneous to this, as you said, there's this guy, I believe his name is Suraj Patel, who, you know, youngish guy, probably under 40, worked for Obama. And I think he ran also, I guess, against one of them in
Maloney,
2020, against Maloney in 2020. And his whole kind of thing is these two are dinosaurs, and he got some traction because I guess, you know, both of them have been not, you know, kind of cheerleading enough for Biden and more generously to him, don't get sort of early 21st century politics where you're not some Solon kind of, you know, dispensing wisdom. Everything's a fight. And you know, if you're not fighting Republicans, you're losing. So at the same time as the two of them were having their own kind of knife fight, you've got this other guy saying, hey, both of you are totally too old and should leave.
Right, exactly.
And so that's sort of the context.
Yeah. So at the end of this, and another interesting part of this is that in the kind of last waning days of the campaign, Chuck Schumer inserted himself, which I thought was really interesting, both because, you know, a guy of his stature, most important person in the Senate, like tend to kind of stay back, especially in a primary, especially behind these two kind of high wattage House members. And then on top of it, that's what basically every other kind of big New Yorker did, you know, Gillibrand saying hands off. But Schumer jumped in and endorsed Nadler in these last few days. And, you know, Nadler did kind of help Schumer out earlier in his career. So I guess it is some, you know, payback. But then Maloney just was like, well, it's the old boys club, you know, that's why you need a woman and blah, blah, blah. And then the New York Times editorial board ended up endorsing Nadler. So that stuff happened towards the end. And as we know, Nadler won handily. Maloney only finished with
doubled her amount.
She got 24%. Nadler had 55%. And then that other guy we were mentioning, Suraj Patel, got about 20%. So she got smooshed.
Really smooshed. And mm-hmm. you know, that it is, you know, kind of in the context of, you know, given that, you know, at this point, I'm trying to remember when he beat Al D'Amato. I think it was in 1998. Chuck Schumer's been in the Senate for like 25 years at this point, been there for a long time. He's the majority leader. He's just, it's even beyond all that stuff. He's just a kind of a, you know, just kind of a kingmaker type guy in the context of New York politics. So someone like that is, you know, he's almost like the daddy of the delegation, right? Mm-hmm. That he's not going to choose between the kids kind of thing. So it did surprise me. Like, it's one thing for him to kind of, you know, maybe make clear in informal ways who he's supporting, but to come out and endorse, wow, you know, that was a surprise. And it's funny. I mean, and this is, as I was telling Kate before we started the episode. I've lived in this part of New York City for about 20 years now. And when I first moved here, the district was Jerry Nadler. And then in 2012, it switched over where it was Carolyn Maloney. So I had both of them as representatives. And my just general impression, and again, I'm not an expert on either. Maybe this is shortchanging Maloney, but Nadler has always been one of these guys who's big on, you know, the big presidential questions and during the Iraq War and the U.S. attorney firing thing and Trump and democracy. And Maloney has always just struck me as more of kind of a, not a machine politician, but just kind of a reliable vote for the Democrats and, you know, completely fine. But that Nadler, I don't know, just kind of someone who operates at a higher level. I don't know. And again, maybe I'm totally wrong. That's just kind of my impression. And it, you know, he demolished her, which really surprises me. Because, I mean, you wouldn't say he's like a dynamic figure.
No.
I mean, not really, right? I was going to say, you know, it's almost good for Carolyn Maloney. She's not going to be in Congress anymore because there'd be a lot of awkward conversations.
Seriously.
Right, in the cloakrooms and stuff. But yeah. There we are.
Yeah. So, you know, that was a big one. Another one I wanted to talk about is that because of this redistricting, Sean Patrick Maloney, who is kind of the head of the House's, DCCC campaign stuff, he was suddenly in a much more Republican district than he was before. So he chose instead to run in a different, friendlier district, which, oops, already occupied by this freshman, Mondaire Jones. He's young and black and gay and kind of like, you know, and a progressive politician, all that kind of stuff. So that in itself caused a bit of an uproar. You know, AOC, I think, probably most prominently called on Maloney to resign as the chair of the DTRIP because their whole shtick is we don't make life harder for incumbents, right? Because the whole purpose is to try to pick up more seats. And here he is kind of putting that aside when it comes to his own political fortunes.
And I guess the idea was is that he could probably hold on, but why make it harder for himself?
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
And so, you know, poor Jones.
I just want to understand one more thing here. It's not that they put him into Mondaire's district. Basically, that his district took on more of those rural conservative counties out, you know, an hour plus past New York City, and gave up some of those inner suburbs, maybe even part of the Bronx or something like that. So it kind of shoved his district further north, made it more conservative, and he just kind of hopped over and took the sort of the bluer part of what was his district, and it left what had been the incumbent sort of out of luck.
Right. And so Mondaire Jones basically has to find somewhere else to run. So instead of, well, decide, I guess
that's kind of the question now.
Bullied out of running in his own district. So he moves on to a much more competitive open seat. And like, you know, his kind of vague claim is it's where Stonewall is. So he says it was a youthful haunt of his and he feels very connected, like a spiritual home kind of thing. So messy.
And just in the context of for our listeners, in the context of New York City, these are very different districts. I mean, this is like I was representing Maine, but my heart's in Arizona. So I'm I mean, again, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like opposite ends of the city.
Right. So then after all this, what happens is Sean Patrick Maloney wins. You know, he is safe. Good job. He made the selfish choice and was rewarded. And then Jones got freaking flattened. He came in third in this open seat. So, yeah, just another, you know, this New York redistricting cycle has just created some really vicious Democratic infighting. And that's another one of those emblematic situation.
Well, it's also, you know, this shows something. And, you know, we have spent so much time in recent years rightly talking about how the representatives should not choose their voters. Voters should choose their representatives, just as a fundamental thing. The people who are running should not be in charge of, you know, writing the district lines to ensure they win or ensure their party wins, all that kind of stuff. Shouldn't be political. You should take the politics out of it. That is mostly true. But what happened in New York shows that it is not always true. It's not completely true. And what we, so and what I mean by that is you had, I don't remember exactly the background, but the person they chose, I think it's fair to say that I don't think they had a political, they didn't have a political axe to grind. This person came at it with a staunch belief that districts should be, what is the word exactly? You know, squares, basically, right? They shouldn't be wiggly and have all these lines and all this kind of stuff. They should be compact and kind of like there's just one area and that area votes. But as Kate said, that's not how actual demography works. You have, you know, historic and not just historic, you know, you have communities in the city. There are different places where different ethnic communities, sort of cultural communities exist. So if you just come in with like a cookie cutter and just kind of cut through that, that's, you know, that cuts through the kind of the existing realities of how those places are actually structured. At the same time, you can make an argument that, you know, the representatives in those two districts had representatives they liked, and they were deprived of voting for their representative. Well, how does that work? I mean, I'm not saying that can never happen. That does happen. But at a basic level, there are these other, contending priorities that have validity to them. Mm-hmm. That you, you know, if you have a, you know, a predominantly Dominican neighborhood in a, you know, somewhere in Queens or somewhere in Brooklyn, that you should try to keep that in one district, right? Because that's one community, as opposed to kind of, you know, divide it up between three districts because it makes sense for your squares. I'm not saying it's the only thing. Obviously, there's a lot of different, you know, a lot of different moving parts there. Or that other point of kind of like, okay, you could draw them differently, but this district has this representative. They elect this person. This other district has a representative. If you don't have to, isn't there an argument for kind of allowing those people to have their, the person they've already voted for? And this, it obviously wasn't great for Democrats, but as you say, it kind of just sliced through the whole politics of the city in ways that it's at least worth considering, that our belief that politics should have no role of, should have no role in redistricting is not an absolute. At least at the margins, there are some complexities there.
I think there are some really easy questions to answer about some about redistricting, and then some legitimately complex ones, like you're saying. I mean, you can also think of the case of like multiracial coalitions, right? Which is where maybe there aren't enough Black voters to sway the vote, but, you know, say Black voters and this Asian American population tend to vote the same, and together they make up enough of the vote share to actually have a powerful say. There have been a lot of cases around that kind of coming up through the VRA lately, but that's another tricky case where maybe that doesn't fit into a square, but it brings up the question of, is it sometimes worth kind of keeping the political stuff in mind and manipulating the borders such to give people more voting power? You know, I mean, you could see the debates on either side of that. And it is, it does kind of play into this question of, do you just cut it into a grid? Do you try to keep these communities together? I mean, it's some of these questions are definitely, I think, difficult and can have legitimate arguments.
Yeah, I think as in many cases, how you redistrict is a complex question for all the reasons we're describing. What I think was bad about this is that it shouldn't have been left to the quirk of some academic who just really believes in compact districts, right? I don't even have the sense that the judge even it wasn't that the judge said, I'm a compact district man. I got to find a compact district ideologue. They just found some political scientist somewhere. And it happened that this is what he believed. Well, that's a pretty random thing. You know, that's a pretty random factor to have such a big effect. I think what it comes down to is that there are a range of, you know, a whole other issue is some people believe that districting should prioritize competitive districts because you want a lot of participation. You want a lot of turnover. Well, there's an argument for that, but it's not obvious that that's a good thing. The point is, there are a lot of complicated questions. It is certainly the case that you shouldn't be doing it to make sure that even though your party only gets 50% of the votes, you get 75% of the seats all the time. Mm-hmm. That is clearly not okay. Right. And that is, that's what 90% of, that's what 90% of the politics of redistricting today is about. You know, a lot of these states in the Midwest where, you know, like Wisconsin, it's 50-50 state, but the Republicans have a permanent supermajority. Mm-hmm. In the state legislature.
Right.
That doesn't make sense.
I mean, and that's, I think, a really critical point, because would anyone be weeping tears over New York becoming more competitive and maybe these incumbents having to like run hard races if that was the case in the whole country? I don't think so. I mean, you know, you're a politician, like that sucks that your district became harder, but that is kind of, that's how the cookie crumbles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And frankly, I think in a lot of ways, even though it's been sort of painful to watch in some of these cases, it shakes things up. That's not bad. Yeah. That's not bad.
Right. But the problem is, you know, I think the reason why there was legitimate reason for being upset that New York went down this way is just because that's not how it is. In most of the country, House races are almost never competitive. And like you say, Republicans in particular have so successfully just eked out strangleholds over states where the voting composition does not reflect it. And when that's your reality, New York Democrats not being able to squeeze out another four seats, like that's a real problem, because then we're on the trail to Republicans just having kind of a permanent hold on the House of Representatives, which, you know, as we, for a whole number of reasons, you know, that's a problem, or at least having a severe edge with the House at all times.
Yeah, no, it is as it is in every case. It's not fair if one side is doing it the fair way and the other side is doing it the unfair way.
Right.
It's just not. And that's obvious.
Yeah. So do you want to give us a little primer on Laura Loomis in Florida, who had an electoral appearance last night?
Yeah. So that brings us to Florida. And you would know more about, I want to just spend a moment on this. You know more about this than I do, Kate. But so we have, as I mentioned before, we got these three states, New York, Florida, and Ohio, where Republicans had things fall in their favor pretty dramatically at the last minute. What's interesting is that there's some complexity, but in Florida and Ohio, in both cases, the state Supreme Court said, no, you can't do this. This is too much. You're redistricting too much. And basically, in both cases, a mix of the governor and the legislature said, no, sorry, and just did it anyway. Now, there's a little more complexity there, but not much. So at a certain level, they played harder hardball. They kind of overruled. And again, the details. And do you remember the specifics here?
So what was really interesting about Florida is that for a long time, it was a back and forth between DeSantis and the really Republican legislature. Like that was where kind of the conflict originated, because basically Florida Republicans wanted to gerrymander, but they wanted to gerrymander in a way that wouldn't kind of raise up red flags for the courts, which has been a real consideration in red states, you know, especially if you've got kind of a red friendly court. You don't want to force them to act.
Yeah.
You want to be just not egregious enough that they let it fly. Whereas DeSantis was like, nope, I want to do maximal aggression. And if that means kind of getting rid of a district that was specifically made to you know, kind of amplify the voices of Black voters, then we shall strike it, you know, to the point that the legislature passed a map that was kind of a mix of the two stances of what the legislature wanted and what DeSantis wanted, but DeSantis vetoed it because it wasn't aggressive enough.
Right.
Eventually the legislature just kind of said, okay, fine, we'll pass your map, and they did it in a special session. So since that point, challenges abound, not least because this one district in the fifth, or this one fifth district, which was specifically made to kind of correct for the diluting of Black votes in Florida, which had been happening. So our latest news on that front is that the Florida Supreme Court, which has become super conservative because of these gubernatorial appointments, they said, we're not going to fast track the challenge to the map, no rush, you know, which means that they will probably be using the super aggressive DeSantis map, at least for the 2022 midterms, which in effect will give Republicans four more seats by taking one new one and then three seats that were previously like very competitive and just making them safely Republican.
Right. It sounds like the state Supreme Court in Florida has basically mm-hmm. said, all right, we're probably not going to be able to okay this, but let's not rush. Let's give you at least one cycle where you can have this nutso map. And what's always important for our listeners to remember here is that, you know, we see people in exclusively partisan terms, but they're not only partisans, they're also incumbents. They want to stay in office. So yes, they want to maximize their partisan power, but they're already in power.
Mm-hmm.
Republican hegemony in Florida is not in doubt. And if you are someone in a safe Republican seat, you don't want to worry about getting it really gummed up in the court and suddenly some special masters, you know, rewriting the districts, and maybe your district gets rewritten a little. I mean, basically what happened in New York.
Right.
You don't want to have that. So that's why you would have, it's not like the, you know, these Florida Republican legislators were like nicer than DeSantis, just their interests are different. Okay. Yep. And then Ohio. So there you had the Supreme Court saying no a bunch of times. And then how did that shake out?
Yeah. So I guess what's happening in Ohio is interesting because they do have a redistricting committee, and the Ohio Supreme Court is definitely more, you know, like sane than the Florida Supreme Court. So they invalidated a map in January enacted by the legislature and the governor, saying, you know, it's way too aggressive of a gerrymander. And then in March, the Republicans on the redistricting committee approved a replacement map that was like basically the same, barely fairer than the one that was struck down. And we're talking 11 Republican leaning seats and two Democratic leaning seats in Ohio, which I think we all agree by this point is a red state, but it's not like Alabama, you know.
It's like a 55-45 state.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And, you know, people kind of rank the efficiency gaps of these maps, which is a good measure of how tilted it is. That Florida one we were just talking about was an R plus 22, okay, a huge Republican gerrymander. That was DeSantis's map. This Ohio one is the one passed by the commission to kind of appease the Supreme Court was a R plus 16. So they're not really trying to make it very.
And so, and basically that measure is the delta between if we just had a statewide race of who should control the legislature X, and then how it's likely to turn out with these seats. That's that delta, correct?
Right, right.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so basically, you know, the thing about this is that there's also like a challenge continues for the state Supreme Court, but it looks like it won't be wrapped up in time for the midterms. But the thing about Ohio that's kind of striking is this commission is a direct result of voters trying to pass reforms. Voters basically saying that we want this to be a less partisan process. And part of that is if the maps that the commission passes only pass along party lines, that they're only good for 2 years. or two election cycles, rather. So then they'll have to be voted on again. Not particularly a great thing in Ohio, which is getting redder because, you know, a curtailed redistricting cycle will probably just mean more Republican seats, even just naturally by the way that the state is trending. Right. But, you know, the egregious thing here is that the Republicans on the redistricting commission were just, they were just kind of out of control. Like, they kept blowing deadlines and not respecting the rules and, you know, kind of toying with what they could get away with. I mean, the whole thing was just, it was such an exercise in bad faith. And I think it has been a recurring theme for us on this show that the voters' will in ballot referendums is just becoming like, you don't even have to pretend to respect it in these Republican legislatures. You know, they just will do what they want and kind of override that. And this was a really a good example of that happening.
Yeah, I do. I do. I think that is something we are going to be seeing over the coming years, that that is a disconnect that I don't think is sustainable over time. If referenda, you know, historically there are certain cases where you have a referendum and it just makes no sense, right? It's something that you can't actually do, but it catches fire with people. And then mm-hmm. the government's trying to kind of, you know, make it work and whatever. And it's sort of one of the arguments against the referendum process. You know, one of the states that has a very, expansive proposition referendum process is California, where I spent most of my childhood. And there you've got this case where the propositions are written in, not only are they not written in legislative language, they're not written in anything close to legislative language. And mm-hmm. and it can be hard sometimes to enact them into laws. But you know, we had the case in Florida a couple years ago, or maybe 4 years ago, with felon disenfranchisement that they just basically ignored and just ignored it basically. And if you have a functioning political system, the results of propositions and referenda should not be totally different from what the legislative and political process is creating. If there's a big differential, something's wrong. And I think we're going to see that playing out because, again, I don't think that is, I don't think that's sustainable over time, but we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. So this has been a long approach to come back to Loomis in Florida.
Yes. Right. Okay. Sorry about that. Yes. Okay.
No,
so Laura Loomer is basically kind of like a right-wing troll, kind of alt-right figure who's been bouncing around for, you know, the last 6 or 7 years. She ran in a congressional primary either in 2020 or 2018, didn't get that far. She was running again, I think, against this guy Webster, I think his name is, representative down in Florida, pretty well entrenched, you know, representative. This was not seen as like a big issue, but she came pretty close to beating him. Mm-hmm. There was a point last night as the returns are coming in, they come in pretty quickly in Florida, where it seemed like she might win. And I think it ended up being like she got 44% of the vote. He got 51. Mm-hmm. So he won. But I mean, it was a close call. And it's funny, sort of, you know, entirely predictably, she's saying voter fraud now and there needs to be a recount and stop the steal. And, you know, in fairness to her, in Republican terms, that's almost like too close to call. Right. I mean, 44%. Yeah. I mean, what else is she going to do? Of course, she's going to say that. So that was a, you know, close doesn't count. But, you know, she got close. So you got that ongoing issue there with, you know, you can't even say they're mainstream Republicans anymore. You have, you know, one of the funny thing is, you know, Matt Gaetz, who we all know is one of the sort of the most feral Trumpers in the House. He had a primary challenger. But not like a more normal person. He had someone running, you know, notionally running against him from the Trumpian right. This guy's big closing argument was that maybe Gaetz is the Mar-a-Lago leaker. Yeah. He betrayed Trump. Now, Gaetz like destroyed this guy. I think the result, end result, was like 60-30 or something like that. But you just, you know, it's the process we've seen. The process we've seen over, you know, really the last two decades that you just, you know, each new crop of, you know, Republican extremists, three cycles in, they're going to be the sort of the rhinos who are getting challenged by the new wackier people. And in some ways, you know, what is one of the things that we're seeing in this sort of differential between seeming like the Democrats are going to win the Senate, seeming like they're probably going to lose the House. A lot of that is that crap's harder to pull off in a statewide race. You know, when you have a non-manageable constituency, when you can't draw the borders, when you've got some liberal cities in the mix, not just rural areas, it's kind of hard. It's hard to run those kind of people. Now in the Senate, you've got this extra issue where in a number of these races, Donald Trump just decided someone was cool and made them the nominee, basically. I mean, that's really what it is. I mean, that's certainly the case in Georgia with Herschel Walker, certainly the case with Mehmet Oz in Pennsylvania. I mean, there is no universe in which either of those dudes would even be in the race, let alone the nominee, without just Donald Trump just deciding it, right? Then you've got people like J.D. Vance in Ohio. He's not a creation of Trump. I mean, Trump did, I think, get him over the edge at the end by a late endorsement. And then you've got this guy, Blake Masters, this kind of like, you know, incel chieftain from Arizona, this like complete weirdo who's like a product of the Peter Thiel, cinematic universe, right? Who's like running like 10 points behind Mark Kelly. In Arizona. I mean, Mark Kelly we're figuring like there's no chance he was going to get reelected, right? I mean, he barely squeaks in on the sort of the anti-Trump coattails. And now he's like at 51% and Masters is like at 40%. You know, you run these kind of like lunatic people. States have been, you know, we haven't had a state, I think, what is it? Was Oklahoma or... can't remember if it was Oklahoma or New Mexico. I think there was one state, maybe 1909. I can't remember. In any case, we haven't had long new states with the exception of the non-continental Hawaii and Alaska for a really long time. They haven't been gerrymandered in a really long time. They're old, right? So you've got a lot of, you know, even in pretty conservative states, or you've got a lot of different kinds of people there. And like, you know, Ohio, Tim Ryan's really given J.D. Vance a run for his money. And I think everybody agrees that J.D. Vance is not a good candidate. I'm not saying he's too right wing. That's a separate issue. He's just not a good candidate. But Ohio's a Republican state, so he has a good chance of pulling it off. But that's always the difference between the House and the Senate. You can't come up with your own districts.
Yeah. I mean, and I think we didn't talk about this on the pod last, it happened in between, but McConnell gave this like kind of shockingly serious or candid statement about candidate quality. He said that candidate quality has a lot to do with the outcome. He said, I think there's probably a greater likelihood than the House flips than the Senate. We have a 50-50 Senate and a 50-50 country, you know, blah, blah, blah. It'll be either our side up slightly or their side up slightly. But like, wow, that is quite an admission of failure to make as the Senate minority leader in what, August, before these midterms, basically coming out and going on the record being like, yeah, this chamber might be out of hand. Like, that's kind of stunning.
You know, the funny thing, it is stunning. And it's certainly, you know, the one thing I think is most important for the Democrats right now in the House is for Democrats to understand they can hold the House. It's not impossible. They can hold the House, especially after what we saw last night. Now, am I saying it's likely? No, but it can happen. And you say that because you don't want people to become demoralized, right? Because you can have something that's possible, but if everybody thinks they're going to lose, they will lose. So it's a striking thing for McConnell to say, because he's basically saying like, yeah, we fucked up. We're losing. So like, that's a bummer for people who are, you know, trying to, if you're a candidate trying to get someone pumped for your campaign. But, you know, even if he is evil, Mitch McConnell's a smart guy, and he's a canny and sly guy. And what I saw in that comment was basically, fuck you to Trump and everybody who likes Trump, because you lost us the Senate. So it wasn't like an admission of like, I messed up. It's that you idiots blew it for us. Good job.
Yeah.
Good job, guys. Right. So, you know, there you go. And it's funny because, there was a poll that came out, you know, like a reputable poll that came out in the last few days showing J.D. Vance back ahead. But generally speaking, they've showed Tim Ryan ahead. I think I'm not convinced that that one poll changes things. But in states like Ohio, you've got a lot of partisan muscle memory that will probably bring J.D. Vance over the, you know, over the hump in the final analysis. But if you look at just who's ahead right now, like, Republicans are behind in every competitive Senate race. They're even a little behind, I think, in North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And was it North Carolina? There was at least one poll showing Val Demings tied with Marco Rubio. Now, I'm not expecting Val Demings to beat Marco Rubio, but like, even in races that are supposed to be totally safe, they're at least close. So, candidate quality matters a lot, but it's not just that. If you can't control who the voters are, it becomes a lot harder.
Totally.
Right? It becomes a lot harder. It's as simple as that.
Yep. Okay, let's jump to this question that we got from Christopher. Yeah, so he says, in a recent podcast episode, we kind of talked about whether or not Liz Cheney might run in the Republican presidential primary and, you know, the pros and cons of that. And he asks, why would they let her do that? I grant she could find the money, no problem, but it seems weird to me that Trump would want to face her and her criticisms. And why wouldn't the people who run the primary just do what Trump wants? Or even if somehow he's in the race with other people, you know, DeSantis or whoever, I can't see her being allowed on stage with those people. I assume the GOP sets the rules, and even if excluding her required a fairly flagrant violation of prior rules, that hardly seems like something they'd have a problem with. What am I missing?
Here's what you're missing. I think if Liz Cheney runs for president in the Republican primaries in 2024, what you're describing is more a feature than a bug. Let's play this out this way. They could certainly, the Republican Party and the Republican candidates are in charge of like who's on debate stage. No question about that. Okay. In terms of who is allowed to run in a primary, that's a lot more difficult. If it is not really contested, they could just not hold primaries, right? If everybody just decides Trump's the nominee, they can do that. I believe they did do that in 2020. But if he does have challengers, primaries are partly run by the parties, but they're also run by the state voting apparatus. Okay. You can't have a primary where Ron DeSantis needs to get such and such number of signatures to get on the ballot, and Mike Pence does, and, you know, whoever else, and just Liz Cheney can't be on the ballot. You can't do that, because, again, these are not strictly partisan elections. They are administered by the state. Right. So you just can't really do that. Now, what they could do is just say she's not really a Republican and we're not letting her on the debate stage. But I guarantee you she will be outside of the convention center where they're holding it every single time. And the whole debate process will become this thing of Liz Cheney out there denouncing Donald Trump and, you know, crapping on him. And why is Donald Trump afraid to appear on the same stage as Liz Cheney? So, yes, they can try to freeze her out. And if they choose to, they can definitely freeze her out of debates. There's no question about that. There's no, you know, constitutional issues with debates. They can do those any way they want. they can't really, if they're having a contested primary, they cannot really keep her off the ballot. That is, I think, unless at the margins, basically impossible. Again, because they're administered by the state. Okay, that is a big thing in states where there are primaries as opposed to caucuses. And, you know, many states have it where, you know, independents or even Democrats can cross over. So even though we know that Liz Cheney is dead to most Republicans, it's not at all beyond the possibility that she could consistently be getting 10, 15, even 20% of the vote in a Republican primary. She's not going to get 1%. There are Republicans who don't like Trump. There definitely are. And again, there's certainly independents who might cross over. So yes, they probably will try to do all of those things. But the process of doing all of those things will become such a glaring issue that I think that in itself will accomplish much of what Liz Cheney would be trying to accomplish, which would be to damage Donald Trump. It's not like Liz Cheney thinks she's going to be the Republican nominee. So that's my basic sense. It is, yes, of course they will try, but it is much, much harder than you might think. And to the extent that they can easily do things with debates, again, that's going to make the whole debate kind of about Liz Cheney, mm-hmm. which defeats the purpose for Republicans and for Trump.
I'm just like imagining her, you know, how the State of the Union always has the rebuttal from the opposing party, just like, you know, at a little stand up with her mics outside the convention center. And then it's like split screen debate. And then you have Liz Cheney outside.
Yeah. I mean, again, we don't think she's going to be the nominee, but it is quite possible because of the dynamics that I described that she could be coming in second or third if there's 8 or 9 Republicans running, right? If she's getting, say, 5%, upwards of 10% of actual registered Republicans, which I don't think is impossible, plus crossovers in a divided field, she could be getting 15%, which could be, you know, coming in third. And then like it just creates chaos, which is what she wants to do.
Right.
You know, you could say productive chaos, but chaos. She wants to stink up the room.
Yep. All right.
So let me remind everybody that the Josh Marshall Podcast brought to you by Grady's Cold Brew Iced Coffee. You can get 25% off with the promo code TPM at Grady'sColdBrew.com. That's Grady'sColdBrew.com. Promo code TPM.
All right. See you guys next week.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe wherever you listen.
One, two, three, four. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.